Dr. Lyle asked what time he should be done today. I told him we were always out by 12:45, right? But actually, I've told him to take his time, and y'all are a great group of listeners, and we just want to hear what he has to say. So you welcome Dr. John Lyle as he comes.
All right. Well, good morning, folks. It's good to be with you today. Thank you for braving the elements and coming out here to hear about the Christmas star. And this is from Matthew chapter 2. If you want to turn in your Bibles to Matthew chapter 2, I'm going to be reading the first part of that chapter. And then what I'll do is I'll go back and kind of exposit it, and we'll see if we can figure out what the Christmas star was. Matthew chapter 2, beginning in verse 1. Now after Jesus was born in Bethlehem of Judea in the days of Herod the king, behold, Magi from the east arrived in Jerusalem, saying, "Where is he who has been born king of the Jews? For we saw his star in the east and have come to worship him." And when Herod the king heard it, he was troubled, and all Jerusalem with him. And gathering together all the chief priests and scribes of the people, he began to inquire of them where the Christ was to be born. And they said to him, "In Bethlehem of Judea, for so it has been written by the prophet, 'And you, Bethlehem, land of Judah, are by no means least among the leaders of Judah. For out of you shall come forth a ruler who will shepherd my people Israel.' Then Herod secretly called the Magi and ascertained from them the time the star appeared. And he sent them to Bethlehem and said, 'Go and make careful search for the child. And when you have found him, report to me that I too may come and worship him.' And having heard the king, they went their way, and lo, the star which they had seen in the east went on before them until it came and stood over where the child was. And when they saw the star, they rejoiced exceedingly with great joy. And they came into the house and saw the child with Mary his mother, and they fell down and worshipped him. And opening their treasures, they presented to him gifts of gold and frankincense and myrrh. And having been warned by God in a dream not to return to Herod, they departed for their own country by another way. Now when they had departed, behold, an angel of the Lord appeared to Joseph in a dream, saying, 'Arise and take the child and his mother and flee to Egypt and remain there until I tell you, for Herod is going to search for the child to destroy him.' And he arose and took the child and his mother by night and departed for Egypt and was there until the death of Herod, that what was spoken by the Lord through the prophet might be fulfilled, saying, 'Out of Egypt did I call my son.' Then when Herod saw that he'd been tricked by the Magi, he became very enraged and sent and slew all the male children who were in Bethlehem and all its environs from 2 years old and under, according to the time which he had ascertained from the Magi." And I think we'll stop there. It's a fascinating part of history, and it's something that a lot of people have questions about. What was this mysterious star, and who were these Magi, and what's going on here? And so what I'd like to go through now and go verse by verse and kind of exposit this passage. So beginning in verse 1, and I'll spend a lot of time in the first two verses because there's a lot of background information here that I think will enrich this passage and help us to understand it a little better. So verse 2, now when Jesus was born in Bethlehem, the name means house of bread. And it's very fitting that Jesus, who is the bread of life, should be born into the house of bread. The Lord likes to do things like that. And it's always neat when he does. Now, this was prophesied in Micah chapter 5, verse 2. It prophesies that the Messiah will come from Bethlehem. It's kind of an interesting verse and perhaps not widely known. Herod, the wise men apparently were not aware of this verse or didn't understand its meaning. Neither was Herod. He had to consult the experts of the people, the scribes, and they understood that the Messiah was to be born in Bethlehem. Micah chapter 5, verse 2 is also a text that I would use when I'm debating with someone who doesn't believe that Christ is God. There are a sect of folks who say that Christ is created by God, that he's not himself God. Well, I don't see how you can reconcile that with Micah chapter 5, verse 2, because it says a ruler will come forth from Bethlehem. His goings forth have been from the days of eternity. So this ruler that's going to come into the world has always existed, which means he's God, because only God has always existed. He's not a creation of God. And that verse might have been perplexing to Old Testament Jews. We get the impression that the Jews of the Old Testament didn't fully understand the gospel. They had enough of it. They understood that we're saved by faith through grace. They understood that. They understood, at least in a preliminary way, the idea of substitutionary atonement. That was the point of those sacrifices. The animal sacrifices didn't save them. They pointed forward to the Messiah who would save them. And yet we have evidence that they didn't fully put all the pieces together. The disciples were surprised when Jesus was crucified, and they were devastated, despite the fact that he told them on countless occasions that he was going to be crucified and rise from the dead, and yet they were surprised when it happened. They didn't fully understand that the whole point of the Messiah coming into the world is to die in our place, and then to rise again, proving that he is who he claimed he was, that he has power over life and death. So he was born in Bethlehem of Judea in the days of Herod the king. So we need to talk about Herod a little bit. Herod was a very wicked, wicked man, if you didn't get that from the fact that he slaughtered two-year-olds and under in Bethlehem because one of them had the title King of the Jews, a title that he wanted for himself. He thought of himself as the King of the Jews. He had bribed his way into power. As far as we know, he's not Jewish and had no right to the throne. He's not a descendant of David. Christ does have a right to the throne. He is a descendant of David, legally, of course. Herod had executed his wife and two of his sons. It gives you an idea of how wicked this man was. He's threatened by a toddler. So, again, he has toddlers killed, which is just ridiculous. One of his own sons tried to poison him. On his deathbed, Herod rounded up a lot of leaders in Israel and had them thrown into prison with the order that when he died, they would die. That way there would be weeping in Israel over his death. Now, fortunately, the order was not followed. But that gives you an idea of how sick this man is, how detestable, how wicked. This is the wicked environment into which God placed the infant Christ. And it's Matthew, especially this chapter, is just so full of irony. We've read it before. We've read it many times. And so sometimes we get used to it and the irony is lost on us. But think about this. God himself's coming into the world. You'd think, well, he'll come in as a conquering king. He comes in as a baby. You can't think of anything more helpless than a baby. And a human baby. I mean, animals, when they're born, they have at least some ability to care for themselves a bit, but human beings, we're utterly helpless when we come into the world. We're completely dependent on our parents for life and sustenance and so on. And so that's the way that he comes into the world, this innocent baby under a king who is evil, under an empire that is wicked. The Roman Empire at this point had conquered the world, and they allowed often other nations to exist and have their own internal structure and even their own religion, as long as they paid tribute and recognized Caesar as the ultimate king, the king of kings, as it were. This is the environment, this wicked, massive empire, and God sends a baby into the world to deal with this. Isn't that interesting? And it makes for a wonderful story. It's true, it's history, but it makes the story interesting, doesn't it? We like, human beings, we like an underdog story. There's something compelling about a story, a movie, or a book in which the underdog, somebody who has to face overwhelming odds and then somehow succeeds. And that's just wonderful. And that's what we have. That's what we have in the gospel. And usually, if you think about it, there are a lot of movies that follow this formula, a lot of books that follow this formula, where there is a hero. There's a problem that has to be dealt with. In this case, it's the problem of sin, the problem of evil. And there is a hero who is raised up, who did not cause the problem, but nonetheless has to deal with it. And then there comes a moment towards the end of the book, towards the end of the movie, where it seems like all is lost. It seems like that's it. There's no way he can succeed now. And then there's this turnaround, and there's this triumphant victory, and the hero succeeds. Think about how many movies and how many books follow that basic formula. And it's a biblical formula. It's the one that God used. That's why it's good. God knows how to write a good story, and he does it in the form of history. So then these magi come. Magi from the east. Now, magi, it's the Persian word meaning priests. So they're priests, they're scholars. The magi were the scholars of the ancient world. And they're probably from the Persia area. Persia was east of Israel. And so that would make sense. Now, this is the area including and surrounding Babylon. Babylon, of course, being known as a very wicked city. And it was the city that had captured Judea at one point. So the Israelites were captured by Babylon. Philo describes the Magi as men who gave themselves to the study of nature and contemplation of the divine perfections, worthy of being counselors of kings. And so these priests, these scholars from Persia, would actually counsel kings. If you were a king, you would pay the Magi a handsome fee to come in and give you counsel, give you wisdom. They were the scholars of the ancient world. They were knowledgeable of the sciences. They were knowledgeable of astronomy. You need to understand that astronomy at that time was about predicting motions in the sky so that you would know when to plant and when to harvest. It was a very important science because agriculture revolves around astronomy. You need accurate timekeeping. And at that point, they didn't have mechanical clocks. They had to use the stars to tell you when to plant and harvest and so on. And they would even be able to perhaps predict things like eclipses and so on, which were kind of interesting events, and perhaps they thought to have some significance in the ancient world. So these were the scholars of the day, and they were revered as such. And kings would call upon the Magi to help them make decisions. If there were disputes, if a king had a dispute, or two kings were disputing over who has the right to have the throne, the Magi would be called in to settle such a dispute. And they had the power to do it because they had their own personal army. The Magi were wealthy and had their own private army as a result of that. There were many Magi as well. Now, we don't know how many visited Christ. We know it was more than one because it's Magi's plural. If it was one, it would be Magus. And so there were at least two. Some people think there were three because they brought three gifts. But it seems more likely that there were many Magi. So we just sang We Three Kings, and that's a great song. But they weren't kings, and there weren't three of them. Other than that, it's great. But I actually like that song quite a bit. But in any case, there were many of them, and they would have traveled with their own army. So, you know, this Christmas card picture of these three guys on camels is just not accurate. Picture a massive caravan with hundreds of people traveling. Not on camels, by the way. The Persians were accomplished horsemen. They would have ridden on horseback, almost certainly. Wealthy people did not travel on camels in the ancient world. They traveled on horses. So hopefully I'm correcting some of these Christmas card misconceptions that we have of this account. So, you can imagine what Herod was thinking when these Magi arrive. Right, they arrive from the east in Jerusalem, saying in verse 2, "Where is he who has been born king of the Jews?" So they're arriving in Israel looking for the king of the Jews, but not Herod. Now Herod thinks, well, I'm the king of the Jews. He paid good money for that position. And so you can imagine he's threatened by these people who have the power to depose kings and have the army to do it. He's troubled. He's troubled. You can imagine that. A wicked king who had bribed his way into office is troubled by people who are coming in looking for the rightful king of the Jews. He's troubled. Verse 3 says he's troubled, and all Jerusalem with him. They're looking for him who has been born king of the Jews. Again, we've read it so many times where the irony sometimes is lost on us. Do you understand? No one is born king except for Jesus. You can be born heir to the throne, but nobody's born already being a king. That's unique to Christ. And so again, we see that this is just a wonderful aspect of history, something that's very different from the kind of thing we would experience today. It's very significant that Matthew, the Gospel of Matthew, records this account. No other gospel records it. And that it is Magi from the east who arrive in Jerusalem asking, "Where is he who has been born king of the Jews?" Why is that significant? Because it was not Jews who were looking for the king of the Jews. It was Magi from the east, from Persia, or at least that area. And that was not known to be a God-fearing nation. Babylon is not a God-fearing nation, okay? It's known for the opposite. It's known for how many laws they could try to break. So it's the opposite of that. So it's interesting that it wasn't Jews looking for the king of the Jews, but Gentiles from a pagan nation who were looking for the king of the Jews. Again, irony. The irony that God's people, Israel typified God's people at that time. Not everyone in Israel was a God follower. That was true throughout the Old Testament. But they symbolized God's people. The nation of Israel did. And so it's very ironic that the nation of Israel was not looking, the Jews were not looking for the king of the Jews, but Gentiles from a pagan nation. What an indictment on the nation of Israel. And Matthew is full of indictments on the nation of Israel, to the point that some people have said that Matthew's anti-Semitic. Well, he is Jewish, so that's a little hard to make that claim, I think. But he recognized that the absurdity, that God's people were not looking for God. And that is the case. And we can read that throughout Matthew, by the way. The whole gospel really is an indictment on the Jews for not following the Messiah. We turn over to Matthew. I mean, you can find it in almost every chapter. Matthew 15, for example, where Jesus is, just in verse 1, then some Pharisees and scribes, right? Now, these Pharisees and scribes, because we're so familiar with this, we think of those are the bad guys, right? Those are the bad guys in the story. Those were the religious leaders of the day. Those were supposed to be the people that, I mean, look, oh, you're a Pharisee. Boy, God's favor must be on you. And so, but they came and to Jesus, and why do your disciples transgress the tradition of the elders? For they do not wash their hands when they eat bread. And Jesus answered and said, and why do you yourselves transgress the commandment of God for the sake of your tradition? For God said, honor your father and mother, and he who speaks evil of father or mother shall be, let him be put to death. But you say, whoever shall say to his father or mother, anything of mine that might have been helped by has been given to God. He is not to honor his father or mother, and thus you invalidated the word of God for the sake of your tradition. You hypocrites, rightly did Isaiah prophesy of you, saying, this people honors me with their lips, but their heart is far from me. But in vain do they worship me, teaching as doctrines the precepts of men. Jesus did not have nice things to say about the Pharisees and scribes of the day. And in this particular passage, the Pharisees had taught that if you wanted to, instead of helping your elderly parents financially, instead you could give that money to the temple and give it to God, and that was even better. And Jesus is saying, you're a hypocrite if you think that. Because the Bible says you're supposed to honor your father and your mother. And so if they're elderly and need your help, you better use that money to help them. That's the point that he's making. The Pharisees thought of themselves as very spiritual, and Jesus was pointing out they're just the opposite. If we turn to Matthew chapter 21, let's actually go there. And just briefly, there's all kinds of things, even in this chapter, that could be taken of as an indictment on the Jews. But a passage that's really interesting, this always intrigued me when I was a kid. I didn't understand it. And Matthew chapter 21, verse 18. Now in the morning when he returned to the city, he became hungry. And seeing a lone fig tree by the road, he came to it and found nothing on it except leaves only. And he said to it, no longer shall there ever be any fruit from you. And at once the fig tree withered. And seeing this, his disciples marveled, saying, how did the fig tree wither at once? That's just such a weird thing to have. You know, Jesus comes to a fig tree, and from what I'm told, it was out of season for them at this point anyway. He's hungry. He comes to it to get something to eat, and there's no fruit on it. And so he curses it. He curses a fig tree. I mean, it's inanimate. It's not like it has consciousness. But there's an important lesson here. You see, God created the fig tree to produce fruit. That was its purpose. And when Jesus came to it to receive that fruit, it wasn't bearing fruit. And so what did Jesus do? He cursed it and said, okay, for that reason, there's never going to be any fruit from you. And it withers up. And the next day they come back and it's withered away. It's totally dead. Symbolism? Oh, yeah. Because you see, Israel was exactly that way. Israel was supposed to be an example for the other nations. We read that in Deuteronomy, I think it's chapter 4, God says the other nations should look at your law code and say, what great nation is there like Israel that has a God so close to it as Israel? Israel was supposed to be an example for other nations to follow, a nation that was seeking God, obeying his laws, producing fruit, spiritual fruit. And when God comes to it, when God the Son comes to Israel, does he find it bearing fruit? It's not bearing fruit. And so he curses and says, nevermore. Never again are you going to produce fruit as a nation. Now, individual Jews, of course, can be saved today, but it'll be through the church, right? And we see that again later in this chapter, in the parable of the landowner, beginning in verse 33. Listen to another parable. There was a landowner who planted a vineyard and put a wall around it and dug a wine press and built a tower and rented it out to vine growers and went on a journey. And when the harvest time approached, he sent his slaves to the vine growers to receive his produce. And the vine growers took his slaves and beat one and killed another and stoned a third. Again, he sent another group of slaves larger than the first, and they did the same thing to them. But afterward, he sent his son to them, saying, "They will respect my son." But when the vine growers saw the son, they said among themselves, "This is the heir. Come, let us kill him and seize his inheritance." And they took him and threw him out of the vineyard and killed him. Therefore, when the owner of the vineyard comes, what will he do to those vine growers? They said to him, "He will bring those wretches to a wretched end and will rent out the vineyard to other vine growers who will pay him the proceeds at the proper season." Of course, that's the right answer. And Jesus said to them, "Did you never read the scriptures? The stone which the builders rejected, this became the chief cornerstone. This came about from the Lord and is marvelous in our eyes. Therefore, I say to you, the kingdom of God will be taken away from you and be given to a nation producing the fruit of it." So this gospel that has belonged more or less exclusively to Israel in the Old Testament, he says, it's going to be taken away from you and given to a nation producing the fruit of it. Because when God came to Israel, they were not looking for him. They were not producing his fruit. They were not expecting the Messiah. And so as a result, Jesus says, fine, I'll take the gospel over here to another nation. And that other nation, don't let the word nation fool you. That just means people group. It doesn't have to refer to a political nation. And the other nation that God's going to give it to is the church. And the church will pay him the proper proceeds. The church will bear God's fruit. And in verse 45, "And when the chief priests and Pharisees heard his parables, they understood that he was speaking about them." There's no doubt about what Jesus is talking about. He's talking about the unfaithful Jews, which was the majority of Israel at that time, who rejected him. Of course, there were some faithful Jews as well. The disciples followed Christ. But my point is they were a slim minority. Again, in Matthew 23, we see the woes to the Jews, the woes to the spiritual leaders of the Jews. In verse 13, "Woe to you, scribes and Pharisees." In verse 15, "Woe to you, scribes and Pharisees." 16, "Woe to you, blind guides." Verse 23, "Woe to you," all these woes. And then finally, he comes down to the last part and says in verse 38, "Behold, your house is being left to you desolate." The temple symbolized the fact that Israel was God's chosen people, and that the temple was where God met with man in the Old Testament. And so Jesus saying to them, that's not going to be the case anymore. Your house is being left you desolate. By the way, in the Old Testament, the temple, God would refer to it as my house. Here he says it's your house, because he's not there anymore. Isn't that interesting? He's grown tired of their sacrifices because they're not offered with a sincere heart. And so to prove that God is no longer with Israel as a nation because Israel turned its back on God as a nation, God says, I'm going to destroy the temple. And then he continues that in chapter 24. He says, not one stone will be left on another that won't be overturned. This is the context of Matthew chapter 2. And I think it's probably why this chapter is recorded. I think that's the main point of the passage, is that the Jews were not looking for the King of the Jews. The Gentiles from a pagan nation were. See, God does that. When God's own people won't worship him, he'll call out. He'll bless other people instead. And it was these Gentiles that were blessed with the opportunity to meet and see with their own eyes the creator of the universe. And that's awesome. That's awesome to think about. Now, the Magi apparently had some knowledge of the Bible. How else would they know to look for the King of the Jews? This makes sense, though. They were the scholars of the day. They would have had their own massive library, and they would have had the scriptures of the Hebrew scrolls as part of that library. It would make sense. And what's more, keep in mind, this is, again, the Babylon area. Remember, Israel had been taken captive by Babylon, and so the Jews were there at one point. And the book of Daniel was written during that time period and records events that took place during that time period. And so of all the ancient books they would have had, they certainly would have had the Old Testament scriptures. They would have had access to those. In Daniel chapter 5, verses 11 through 12, it's interesting that Daniel is appointed by the king as the chief of the magicians. And where we get the word magic or magician is magi. It's kind of interesting. So it could have been that he was the leader of that order at that time. And I wish I could tell you it's the same word, but keep in mind Daniel is written in a different language. It's written mostly in Aramaic, and so they're using a different language there. But I think that's probably referring to that he was the chief of the magi at the time that he was in Babylon. And so it could be that these magi that were seeking after Christ are the intellectual descendants of Daniel. Daniel, being a godly man, would certainly have, and being put in charge of the magi or magicians at that time, he certainly would have told them about Christ and about the Bible. And so there, it makes sense that their intellectual descendants would recognize the timing of the Messiah. In fact, as far as I know, Daniel's the only book of the Bible that records the time when the Messiah would come. A lot of books prophesy about Messiah coming. Daniel tells us when. You remember that there are 70 weeks decreed, and those are weeks of years. In fact, it's in the original Aramaic language, it's 77s. It doesn't say seven what, but years is implied. And from the decree to rebuild the temple to the Messiah being cut off would be 70 years, basically, or 69. There's Messiah's cut off in the middle of the last section there. But in any case, they would have known the approximate time, therefore, that the Messiah would have come into the world. And so they would have been looking for him. They would have said, that time's about right. It's been about 490. Yeah, it's we're getting close to the time where the Messiah is supposed to come into the world. Now, how did they know that this star represented the Messiah? That's what I want to know. We have seen his star in the east. His star. Isn't that interesting? They call it his star. It's not a star. It's not, oh, we saw Jupiter or we saw Venus. They would have been familiar with those objects. The names of the planets are very, very ancient. They would have been around before Christ's earthly ministry. They would have known that. They refer to it as his star. Of course, all stars belong to God. They're all his stars, right? But it's interesting that they single it out as his star, the star that's associated with the Messiah. How could that be? One possibility is that they were familiar with Numbers 24:17, which is Balaam's prophecy that says, a star shall come forth from Jacob, a scepter shall rise from Israel. And that poetically refers to a king coming out of Israel. But it's interesting that the symbol it uses is a star rising. That represents a king coming forth. And so when they see the star rise over Israel, they associate that with the king of kings, the king of the Jews coming forth. We'll come back to that in a little bit, but I think that's probably the way that they associated the star with the Messiah. And then they came to Jerusalem, not Bethlehem, and so we need to puzzle over that a little bit. I'm going to suggest that the star was not guiding them at the time. We'll see that when we come to it a little bit later. So they're in Persia, they see the star, and they follow it. And at some point during their journey, the star no longer is guiding them for whatever reason. Did it disappear? I don't know. Were there a series of cloudy nights where they just couldn't see it? That's a possibility as well. And so for whatever reason, they come to Jerusalem. Why Jerusalem? It's the capital city. It would make sense to look for the king of the Jews in the capital city, right? That's where the king lives. And so given that, you know, from Persia, you understand Bethlehem and Jerusalem are only 6 miles apart, so they're very close. And from the distance of Persia, if the star is hovering over Bethlehem, as I think it was, If they see that, they're not going to be able to distinguish Jerusalem from Bethlehem at that distance. In fact, Bethlehem is pretty much due west of Jerusalem anyway, so you can't tell where it's at. They knew it was over Israel, and why not begin their search in the capital city? Was this star particularly bright? I don't think it was. And so again, this is another Christmas card misconception. This incredibly bright star. Herod had to ask them when they saw the star appear, which means he wasn't familiar with it. The other Jews apparently were not familiar with it, which means it wasn't something that was terribly bright or everyone would have been familiar with it, right? You would notice a blindingly bright new star that appeared in the sky. Everyone would notice that. Apparently, this star was unusual in some way, such that folks who were familiar with science, folks who were familiar with astronomy would notice it, but the average layman would not. Or maybe it was supernatural in the sense that only they could see it. I don't know. But in any case, apparently only the Magi noticed the star and followed it. We've seen a star in the east. I have to deal with that little phrase there, in the east, because it's ambiguous. Does it mean we saw his star when we were in the east? Or does it mean we saw his star when the star was in the eastern sky? You see what I'm saying? Does east refer to their position or the star's position? And it's a little bit ambiguous in English. I went back and checked the Greek, and I checked with some folks who are more knowledgeable of Greek than I am. And it's ambiguous in Greek, too. You can't tell. You have to use context to figure it out. I suspect the star being in the east is a little more natural. That seems more natural in the English, right? For we've seen his star in the east, the star in the eastern sky. But then that raises a perplexing question, because they're from the east. They're east of Bethlehem and Jerusalem. And if they see the star in the east, why do they go west, right? I mean, they traveled from the east, which means they went to the west, to Bethlehem, Jerusalem, Israel. Why would they go the opposite direction of where the star is? You see what I'm saying? There's a star, let's go that way. Why? Interesting. It's a little bit of a dilemma. And I think there's a resolution to this. And I went back and looked at the Greek text in the east. It turns out that if you were to translate that word for word, it's actually at its rising. The expression in the east literally means at its rising. So they saw his star at its rising. Now, you need to understand that in the Greek at that time, they didn't have a word for meaning, they didn't have a word that meant west, and they didn't have a word for east. If you wanted to say east, you would say at the rising, because that's where the sun rises. Okay, so if you're heading east, you're heading toward the rising. If you're heading west, you're heading toward the setting. That's the way they would refer to east and west. And normally it doesn't matter. I mean, how should we translate this? Should we translate it literally at its rising, or should we translate it to what they probably meant in the east? And most Bible versions translate it in the east. But there are a couple that translate it at its rising, and I think that's the natural way to do it. The New Living Bible translates it that way, New Living Translation, and the English Standard Version translates it that way as well. We saw a star as it rose, or at its rising. Now, normally there's no difference between the two, because if you see the moon in the east, you're seeing it when it's rising. All natural objects rise in the east and set in the west. It's not just the sun. The moon does it, the stars do it as well. So if you say, I saw the sun in the morning, I saw the sun in the east, well, you saw it as it was rising. If I said, I saw the moon as it rose, well, you saw it in the east. So there's no difference normally for all natural objects. But was the Christmas star a natural object? I'm going to suggest that it wasn't, and that, in fact, it rose in the west, because that would get their attention. If all natural objects rise in the east, and they're looking over Israel, and they see, you know, all the regular stars are setting over Israel, and they see one star rising, going in the opposite direction of all natural stars, rising over Israel, that would get the Magi's attention. Especially if it weren't particularly bright, other people might not even notice it. But the Magi, being familiar with astronomy, would recognize a star that doesn't belong in that constellation. And it rose over Israel in the west and then just hovered there like no natural star would do. And so I'm going to suggest that's probably the way the verse ought to be translated. And then again, when it occurs later in this passage, they saw the star that they had saw in the east, the star that they had seen in the east, the star that they had seen at its rising when it appeared to them again. So that's the background information, and we can go rather quickly through the rest of this. Verse 3, Herod's troubled, not surprisingly. He thinks he's the king of the Jews, and here are these magi who can depose kings, searching for a king of the Jews who's not him. He's troubled. Are they going to remove him from power? The Jews are troubled with him. All Jerusalem's troubled with him. That's disappointing. The Jews, who should have been ecstatic that their Messiah, the promised Messiah who'd been promised back to Adam and Eve, right? God promised that a seed of the woman would crush the serpent's head, the proto-gospel, right there back in Genesis. 4,000 years, people have been waiting for the Messiah. The Jews should have been ecstatic, but instead they're troubled. Disappointing. Verses 4 and 5, Herod summoned the Jewish scholars to provide him with as much information as they could on this Messiah, because he hears about this. He hears the Magi coming. They're searching around. Where is he who's been born king of the Jews? I can imagine they're discouraged because nobody seems to know. Nobody else has noticed the star. Nobody knows where the king of the Jews has been born or that he's been born. So Herod gets as much information as he can from the scribes and the priests of the people, and they inform him about Micah chapter 5, verse 2, that the Messiah was to be born in Bethlehem. So now he's got some information to trade with the Magi. Now it seems to me the Magi weren't familiar with that passage, Micah 5:2, or they didn't understand its meaning anyway. So he then meets with the Magi secretly. If he met with them openly, then the people would know about it, and they could come to the Magi afterwards and say, "You can't trust Herod. He's a wicked king." So instead, he meets with the Magi secretly, and he gets as much information from them as he can. He learns from them about the time the star rose. Now, this is significant because people think, you see a lot of Christmas cards with the manger scene and three wise men there at the manger scene. They weren't there at the manger scene. This is sometime later because remember, later on, Herod has all the male children under the age of two slaughtered in Bethlehem according to the time he learned from the Magi, the time that the star appeared, which means it was apparently 2 years ago. Could have been a little less than that. Herod was probably covering his bases and rounding up. My point is, it wasn't the next day. They had to travel from Persia to Israel, and they didn't have American Airlines back then. So that would have taken some time. That would have taken months, and perhaps they took months to prepare for it. So it would have been over a year after the birth of Christ that the Magi finally arrived. And so they tell Herod, "Yeah, it was a year and a half ago that we saw the star rise, and we're here now." And he rounds up to 2 years, perhaps. It wasn't the next day. Now, the shepherds would have seen him that evening, right? Because they're already there. And the angel says to the shepherd, "For unto you is born this day in the city of David a Savior," which is Christ the Lord. So they could have been there at the manger scene. So the Christmas cards get that one right. But not the wise men. Not the Magi. They would have been there sometime later. Significantly later. There's another way you could realize that, too. And that the fact that the Magi arrived much later, and that is in Luke when we read about the first visit to the temple where Joseph and Mary take Jesus to the temple to perform the sacrifice there. According to Old Testament law, when you had a child being born, there was a purification ritual that they had to go through. And they would offer a lamb and a turtle dove as a sacrifice. And that would, again, that was a purification ritual of the Old Testament that the Lord required. Now, you'll read in Luke, though, that they didn't offer a lamb and a turtle dove. They offered two turtle doves. Why? There was a provision in the Old Testament that if you were too poor to afford a lamb, you could offer two turtle doves instead. That's in Leviticus. And so that what that indicates is that Joseph and Mary had virtually no money at all at the time that Christ was born. Now, remember what the gifts the Magi gave to them? Gold, frankincense, and myrrh. So they would have had some money after that, which means, obviously, the temple ceremony had to happen before the Magi visited them. So that's another way we can confirm that this was sometime later. In verse 8, Herod then sends them to Bethlehem. He gives them the information that he learned from the scribes and the priests that that Christ would be born in Bethlehem. He sends them to that area with instructions, "Hey, come back and tell me about it so I can worship him too." We know that wasn't his intention. And then in verse 9, it's significant that it says, "And having heard the king, they went their way, and lo, the star which they'd seen in the east, or at its rising, went on before them until it came and stood over where the child was. And when they saw the star, they rejoiced exceedingly with great joy." Another one of those passages thinking, well, why did they rejoice? They'd already seen the star. Why did they rejoice? Well, I'm going to speculate it's because the star was not guiding them at that time. You can imagine this scenario. You can imagine that they saw the star back when they were in Persia. They saw it when it rose, and they follow it to Israel. But at that point, it's not there anymore. They can't see it anymore. Clouds, whatever. Because they go to the wrong city. They go to Jerusalem. And then they're asking where to find the child. If the star were guiding them, they wouldn't have to ask. They could just follow the star, right? So it's not leading them. And you can imagine their discouragement. They get to Israel, they get to the capital city. Nobody knows about this person who's born king of the Jews. Herod doesn't even know about it, and he gives them some additional information, but you can imagine their discouragement. Did we get the sign right? Has the Messiah really been born? Does God really want us to see this because the star's no longer guiding us? And then after all that discouragement, after meeting with Herod, then the star appears again. And they rejoice with exceedingly great joy. God is with us. We're going to see. And it's close. Because my suspicion is at that point, I mean, they're only 6 miles away. And so if the star is, I think, close to the earth, as I'll speculate here in a minute, then they would have been able to see that they were very close to their destination. That's why they rejoiced with exceedingly great joy. We are on the right track, after all. We're going to get to see the Messiah. We're going to get to see the King of Kings. And they go, and then the star went ahead of them, it says. So apparently it moved. It went ahead of them, and it stood over where the child was. So it moved and then stopped. Really strange. And it seems to me that this is one where the Christmas cards get it right, that it stopped over the right house, because they already knew he was in Bethlehem. Herod told them that. They didn't need that, you know, they didn't need the star to guide them to just the city. They needed the star to guide them to the correct house. And I think that's the impression I get from the text is that it did. It stood over where the child was, the text says. And so they are able to go and they find the child, not the baby, the child, different Hebrew word. He's a toddler at this point, with Mary, his mother, and they give gifts of gold, frankincense, and myrrh. And the interesting thing is in the Old Testament, a lot of times when one nation would conquer another, sometimes they would allow the king, like Rome did, they would allow the king to continue to exist in that nation, but they'd have to pay tribute. And so the king would offer gifts to the superior king of the superior state, you see. And it turns out the main gifts that they would offer would be gold and aromatic fragrances such as frankincense and myrrh. Isn't that interesting? It's a way of saying, I'm king, but you're the king of kings. And so it's significant that they offered those gifts. So with this information, what was this star? I have to point out that it doesn't have to be a star in the modern astronomical sense of a spheroid of hydrogen gas, billions of trillions of miles away. It doesn't have to be that. That would be a star as well, but you need to understand the Greek word translated star is aster, and it would refer to any point-like luminary in the night sky. And so, you know, perhaps you see this, wow, look at that bright star over there, and then some smart aleck comes and says, that's not a star, that's a planet, that's Jupiter. And, well, under the Greek definition, planets are stars, okay? So it's a little different than our modern definition. It's more broad, it's more encompassing. So planets would count as stars. Comets would count as stars. Comets were hairy stars. That's what the word comet means, hairy, because they had that tail behind them. And so it could include something like that. A small moon would certainly count as a star. Anything that's a point-like luminous source of light in the night sky. A supernova, that's where a star explodes. A lot of people have said that's what it is, you know, a supernova, an exploding star. But there weren't any that coincide with the time of Christ's birth that we know of. And in any case, a supernova is very bright. And again, everyone would have noticed it. This is something that only the Magi apparently noticed, and therefore something that was that an astronomer would notice, but perhaps not a layman. Some people have suggested that the Christmas star is a conjunction of planets. A conjunction is where one object in the sky passes by another. It could be a planet passing by a star or a planet passing by another planet. When they get close, the closest point is called a conjunction. And they're pretty common. Venus and Jupiter conjunct roughly every 13 months on average. Sometimes it's in a convenient location where you can see it. Sometimes it happens in early morning when most people don't bother to get up early before sunrise to see that. But in any case, they're pretty common. Conjunctions happen. I've seen many conjunctions in my life. So they're not that unusual. But it seems to me that there's no way you could call a conjunction a star. Singular. A conjunction is always two stars or more. Okay? So I don't see how you could call that the Christmas star. Now, there were some conjunctions around that time. There was a conjunction of Jupiter and the bright star Regulus. That was in 3 BC on September 13. And it was a little unusual because it was a triple conjunction. Because we're orbiting the sun along with other planets, outer planets occasionally seem to go backwards in the sky. And that's when Earth is passing them. And so you'll see this planet traveling along and then it'll reverse and then go forward again. And that was perplexing to the ancients before they realized Earth orbits the sun too, and then it made sense. But a triple conjunction happens when that retrograde motion happens right at the time Jupiter was passing the star Regulus, and so it kind of looped around it like that. And some people have said, oh, that's very significant because Jupiter was the Roman king of the gods, and Regulus is maybe the king star or something like that. But the problem is, that's not a conjunction is not a star. It just isn't. Nor does it do any of the things that the text says the biblical star did. The conjunction of Jupiter and Regulus did not go ahead of the Magi and stand over where the child was. And the timing's a little bit off, too, because I said that happens in 3 BC and then again in 2 BC. As far as we can tell, Christ was born probably around 4 BC, maybe 5 BC. And so the timing's not quite right there. again in 2 BC, there was a spectacular conjunction of Jupiter and Venus. And some people said, this is it, because this conjunction is very rare, because the conjunction that happened on June 17, 2 BC, was so close that the two objects would probably have looked like one object to the naked eye. So Jupiter and Venus came really close that time, and that is kind of rare. It's not a once-in-a-universe type thing, but it's a once-in-a-lifetime event, certainly. And so some people have said, well, that would count as a star because they're so close. But the problem with that one is that it occurred only once on the evening of June 17, 2 BC. Recall from our text, the wise men saw the star at least twice, once before they met with Herod, right? They saw a star at its rising, and then again after meeting with Herod, and they rejoiced with exceedingly great joy the second time they saw it. But this conjunction happens only once, so that can't be right either. There's a popular DVD that goes around that teaches this particular scenario, but it doesn't fit the biblical text. It just doesn't. And so we have to reject that scenario in favor of the text. The problem with almost all of these, you know, it's a planet, or it's a conjunction of planets, or it's a comet, or it's a supernova. The problem with all of them is that they don't do what the Christmas star did. They don't go ahead of the wise men and then stand over where the child was. In fact, no natural object does that. How can you stand over Bethlehem? There is one star in our sky that stands over a location on Earth, and it is the North Star. And it just the North Star happens to be roughly above Earth's North Pole, and so as the Earth rotates, that star remains in the same position in the sky. But the other stars don't do that. And by the way, the Earth's axis was tilted different when Jesus did his earthly ministry. There was no North Star when Jesus was doing his earthly ministry. That's a recent phenomenon, interestingly. Now, the other thing you could do, you could put a satellite in orbit around Earth's equator, and if you put it at the right distance, it'll orbit at the same rate that Earth rotates. I hope you see the irony of the dilemma here. In order for something to appear stationary, it must move, right? Because we're on a rotating planet. So to stay over Bethlehem, this thing has to orbit as the Earth rotates. Now you could put what they call a geostationary satellite, which orbits over Earth's equator. And we have those today. We have geostationary satellites. But the problem is they have to orbit over Earth's equator. And they will remain stationary over that spot. But Bethlehem is not on Earth's equator. Bethlehem is at a latitude of 31.7 degrees, just 1 degree further south than we are, interestingly. And so you can't put a satellite 30 degrees up like that and have it orbit and have it maintain that latitude. An orbit has to go through Earth's center. So those of you that have a satellite dish, you notice they're always pointed toward the south. Now, it might be southeast or southwest, but they're not pointed up because you can't put a satellite directly over this latitude. It doesn't work in terms of the laws of physics. And so it can't be a natural star. It can't be a satellite or a moon or anything like that. And what that leads me to think is that this is a supernatural manifestation of God's power, because it does things that no natural star does. It goes ahead of the Magi. It stands over the location of Christ. I can't prove that's the right answer, but it's certainly satisfactory, and we shouldn't be embarrassed that God does things sometimes in the Bible that defy natural laws. Natural laws are the way God normally works, but he's not required to work that way, and sometimes he does something that's unusual, which we would call a miracle. We tend to think of the universe as something that just operates kind of independently, like a clock all by itself, and that a miracle is when God intervenes. That's not really a correct conception, though, because the Bible tells us that God upholds all things by the word of his power. And so God is constantly upholding the universe. He's controlling every aspect of it. The reason that electrons orbit protons is ultimately because of God. And the physicist says, no, it's the electromagnetic force. And I would say the electromagnetic force is the name we give to the way that God upholds his creation, you see. It's just giving a name to what God normally does. And so a miracle is no more of an expression of God's power than the normal operation of the universe. Sometimes the atheists would say, well, if I could see a miracle, you know, then I'd believe. Well, first of all, a lot of people saw miracles and did not believe. No, you wouldn't. It would be my response. No, you wouldn't. Jesus said as much, right? He says, if they're not persuaded by Moses and the prophets, they won't even be persuaded if someone rises from the dead. And that was confirmed in Matthew 28:17. Matthew 28:17. This is the resurrected Lord appears. He appears in front of a lot of people, his followers even. And it said, and when they saw him, they worshipped him, but some doubted. In the presence of the resurrected Lord, some doubted. So I tell my atheist friends, it's not the breaking of physical laws that should convince you of God. It's the presence of physical laws that should convince you of God. Because you see, apart from God, how would you have equations like E equals MC squared and F equals MA? The orderliness of the universe is because God controls it and controls every aspect of it. And the fact that we write down neat little equations that describe the way that God upholds his creation makes sense in the Christian worldview because God thinks mathematically. Mathematics is an expression of the way God normally thinks. And so we expect him to uphold the universe in that fashion. So this explanation of a star, a supernaturally created star that rises over Bethlehem, over Israel, on the night that Christ is born and remains there, and the Magi, they see it from the Persia area, they travel west, they saw the star at its rising, and from their perspective, it would have risen in the west, which no natural star does, and so they would have recognized it. They would have seen a star rising over Israel. Ah, wait a minute, the Bible says something about that. Numbers 24:17, a star shall rise over Jacob, a scepter shall rise from Israel. Yeah, that's got to be his star. That's got to be the Messiah's star. No natural star will do that. All the natural stars are setting in the west. This one's rising in the west. And so they get close to there. As they get close to the capital city, they are no longer able to see the star due to clouds or whatever. And they ask Herod, they have their conversation with Herod, the clouds clear, they see the star again, they know they're close. And as the star goes ahead of them, perhaps it moved and led them to the specific location, the house at which Christ was. Now this explanation alleviates five difficulties in the text that I think no other explanation does. First of all, it explains why the Magi went west. If they saw the star, if the expression in the east at its rising, if that meant in the east, then why didn't they go east? Why did they go the opposite way? Well, because that's where the star was. It was in the western sky. It explains how they recognized it as his star, because no natural star rises in the west. The Christmas star apparently did. Today we have, by the way, today you can see stars rise in the west because we have artificial satellites. And they tend to go west to east because it saves fuel to launch them in the same direction Earth's rotating, because we're already moving at 700 miles per hour west, even though you don't feel it. But so today you can see that, but not before 1957. Before Sputnik, you didn't see any stars rising in the west. And so that they would have recognized that as unusual. Third, it explains why only the Magi saw it. If it was not a particularly bright star, somebody else might not have noticed a star rising in the west, or they might not have noticed that they might not have realized that no natural object does that if they weren't knowledgeable of astronomy. Fourth, it explains Balaam's prophecy. A star literally rising over Israel would certainly signify the coming of that king that was prophesied in Numbers 24:17. And fifth, it explains how they were able to be led to the right house. They already knew Christ was in Bethlehem. Herod told them that, but the star apparently led them to the exact location. Natural stars can't do that, right? If you were to say, okay, go stand under Vega. You're like, okay, I think I'm under it now. Right? It's too far away for you to know that you're exactly under it. Anybody within a 100-mile radius would think they're under the same star, if you see what I'm saying. So this explanation fits the text, and you feel free to reject my explanation, but the point is we have to adhere to the text. That's the main thing. And these other explanations that people have offered, they violate the text, and that's not acceptable. So we need to be faithful and let God be God. And I'll grant the Bible doesn't say this is a supernatural action. It doesn't say that. And so it's fine for people to search for natural explanations. That's normally the way God does things. But if none can be found, we need to let God be God and recognize God does whatsoever he pleases. And if he wants to create a new temporary star that hovers over Bethlehem, he can do that. That's not a problem. So I think the main point to take away this morning is, again, what I started with, that the people who should have been anticipating the Messiah, for the most part, were not. Yes, there were some shepherds that got to see Christ, and there were the 12 disciples, and they were Jewish. There's no doubt about that. But Israel as a nation rejected the Messiah, and it was Gentiles from a pagan nation that God used instead. That's always God's pattern. He said, okay, if my people aren't going to seek me, I'll go over here. I'll bless these people instead. That's what God does. And praise God, this was all according to his decree anyway, because God used the rejection of Israel, of the Messiah, to bring salvation to the Gentiles. And Romans 11, Paul explains that and how wonderful that is in God's plan. And God then can use the Gentiles to bring in the Jews as well, all according to his plan. So that's the lesson for us today, is where would we have been in this situation? I mean, we call ourselves followers of Christ, Christians. And the Jews thought that they were followers of the living God as well. And yet, when the sign appeared, they were oblivious to it. They were not seeking the King of Kings. And as a result, they missed out on a blessing. But pagans who responded to the sign, they got to see the Creator of the universe in person. Pretty awesome. And so I wonder how many blessings we miss out on today because we're not seeking the Lord. So turn it back over to you, or do you want me to close? I'll turn it back over to you. Very good. Thank you very much for having me out to speak. I appreciate it.
First of all, if you appreciated that, why don't you give him a round of applause? I don't know. Now, I was particularly impressed because he agreed with everything I said last week. So I don't think I've ever heard anyone else really speak on that subject and come to the same conclusion I did. So I feel like I'm in good company today. And you'll have to visit the link that's in the bulletin. And I spent a little more time on Numbers 24:17. But that was fantastic. I took about 8 pages of notes, so it was very enriching for me. Thank you all for recommending him. I appreciate that. I asked Richard to come lead us in a song invitation, and this is the last Sunday of the year. And so last week we talked about celebrating the wonder of Christmas, and we heard more about that today. And I'm just so grateful for the fact that there were people who were seeking the King of Kings, and we want to do that in the coming year. And so as we have the invitation song, I want to invite you maybe to join me at the altar and pray for our church in 2018, that God would bless it with new families, that God would bless it with adequate finances so that we can continue all the mission work. I think some of you have probably seen several emails over the last few weeks about some of the missionaries we support directly. We do that on a constant basis. And we're also support our denominational missionaries, and we're grateful to do that. But let's just pray that we can do even more in 2018 than we did in 2017. I wonder if you'd stand with me as Richard leads us in a song, and if you want to just take a moment or two during the song to come up and pray for God to bless our church in 2018, I want to encourage you to do that. I also want to encourage you, Dr. Lyles on Facebook, his Facebook page for the Biblical Science Institute, so you can follow him there and keep track of his work and find out more about him. So, Richard.
Let's take our hymnals and turn them to hymn number 211, and we're going to sing the first and the third verses. And if we got time, we'll do the fourth as well. Number 211, I Wonder As I Wander.